when Sarah had her only son, she named him Isaac. We don't know a lot about this Old Testament character. His name means laughter, but laughter or causing cheer, it's not really a word we would associate with Isaac as we look at his sparse record in the Bible. Of the major patriarchal figures, we know the least about him. For example, we have between 12 and 13 chapters devoted to Abraham. We have about 9 chapters devoted to Jacob. We have about 13 chapters devoted to Joseph. We have about 1 chapter devoted to Isaac. Genesis 26 is Isaac's chapter. We'll be looking at that here in a few minutes. This chapter tells basically about 3 things. We could add another couple in there, but kind of the big things are Isaac lying to Abimelech about Rebekah being his sister, some conflict between Isaac's servants and the Philistines regarding digging wells, and Abimelech's treaty with Isaac. As you start chapter 27, it actually seems like it's going to continue with Isaac's life, but that's quickly taken over by Jacob and Esau, and then Jacob dominates the next 8 chapters. And this pretty much seems to characterize what we know about Isaac. We might, in fact, as you look through his history, you might kind of call him mistreated. Think about the fact that in his infancy, Isaac became the object of his brother's jealousy. Very young age, not exactly sure how old he was. Chapter 21, verses 8 through 10 says, "The child, Isaac, grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the same day that Isaac was weaned. Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, scoffing. Therefore she said to Abraham, 'Cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, namely Isaac.'" I'm sure there was some residue of this that stayed with Isaac throughout his life. In his youth, Isaac was the intended victim of his father Abraham's sacrifice. When he was 40, we're told that he married Rebekah, his cousin, by whom, when he was 60, he had 2 sons, Jacob and Esau. In chapter 26, we find that he was driven by famine to Gerar, the Philistia area. He acquired great wealth there, but he was repeatedly run off, first by Abimelech and then by the Philistines at different locations. In his elderly years, he was deceived by his wife and his son Jacob. When Jacob stole Esau's blessing from Isaac. And all that we know about him during the last 43 years of his life was that he saw Jacob return to him at Hebron with his whole clan, his family that he brought with him from Haran. And he died at the age of 180, and that's in the last part of Genesis 35. He was buried by his 2 sons in the cave of Machpelah. Several of the things that we just mentioned are noted in the New Testament, and that's pretty much the extent of what we know about Isaac. I want to spend a few minutes looking at chapter 26. It gives us more insight into this man than any other place in the Bible. Chapter 26, verses 1 through 5, basically reiterates the promises to Isaac, the same promises that had been given to Abraham. We're told, this gives us the setup here, that there was a famine in the land besides the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, in Gerar. Then the Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Dwell in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land." We'll come back to this a little bit later. "And I will be with you and bless you, for to you and your descendants I give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham your father, and I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." Not given anything that kind of leads us up to this, him building an altar or anything like this, not given his response or any kind of interaction, just these statements that are made. Verses 6 through 11 gives us this account of deceit, which is quite reminiscent of his own father. We're told that Isaac therefore dwelt in Gerar, verse 6, and it says, "The men of that place asked him about his wife. He said, 'She is my sister,' for he was afraid to say, 'She is my wife,' because he thought lest the men of the place should kill me for Rebekah, because she is beautiful to behold. It came to pass, when he'd been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked through a window and saw, and there was Isaac showing endearment to Rebekah, his wife. Then Abimelech called Isaac and said, 'Quite obviously she is your wife. How could you say, she is my sister?' Isaac said to him, 'Because I said, lest I die on account of her.' And Abimelech said, 'What is this you have done to us? One of the people might soon have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt on us.' So Abimelech charged all his people, saying, 'He who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death.'" Don't know how much this was influenced by his own father's actions, assuming that he probably heard about Abraham participating in this. Certainly something to keep in mind as we live our lives and realizing the impact that our lives and our actions, our attitudes have on our children. I don't suppose anybody else here has ever heard your child say something or see them act in some kind of way and kind of be shocked by that and then realize that they're mimicking you. And that's kind of a humbling experience when it's not a good thing. Some have suggested that this may have been a common practice with married people among strangers and when they traveled in those times of social insecurity. Don't really know exactly, but it is kind of interesting how it just perfectly parallels the behavior of Abraham. This gives us a little insight, but of course Abraham was a very honorable man and he did this, so you can't make more out of it than we should. Picking up in verse 12 sort of changes gears here and introduces us into the prosperous nature of Isaac and how he becomes a powerful and wealthy individual. Verse 12 says, "Isaac sowed in that land," and for those of an agrarian interest, this is the first reference to seed sowing in the Bible. "Isaac sowed in that land and reaped in the same year 100-fold, and the Lord blessed him. The man began to prosper and continued prospering until he became very prosperous. For he had possessions of flocks and possessions of herds and a great number of servants, so the Philistines envied him." Now the Philistines had stopped up all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham his father, and they had filled them with earth. And Abimelech said to Isaac, "Go away from us, for you are much mightier than we." So he sowed and he reaped 100-fold. As I understand, 60-fold was not necessarily an uncommon harvest in that area, but 100-fold was quite well, like investing $1,000 and you get $2,000 return on that. Herodotus indicates that some places in Babylonia there were 200 and 300-fold that they could produce. But this was quite substantial here. And it says, again, he began to prosper flocks and herds, and so the Philistines became envious of him. Had this issue over the wells, and this sets the tone for what's getting ready to happen for a period of time here. And then Abimelech finally says in verse 16, "To go away from us, for you are mightier than we." So not only was he prosperous, also indicates that he was had become powerful as well. His father, of course, we recall, had 318 trained servants in his household. I don't know how much of this was carried forth with Isaac, but seems to indicate that he was a potentially prominent individual. This is the first instance on record of what the Greeks call ostracism, a term that they coined, as I understand, which means the banishment of a person from the state because of the people being jealous of the individual becoming powerful, becoming wealthy, becoming influential. And then we see it repeated in a little bit different direction as we press on verses 17 through 22. As a result of that, verse 17, Isaac departed from there, pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar, and dwelt there, still in that general area. And then we're told that Isaac again dug the wells of water which they had dug in the days of Abraham his father, for the Philistines had stopped them up after the death of Abraham. He called them by the names which his father had called them. Also, Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found a well of running water there, but the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, "The water is ours." So he called the name of the well Esek, because they quarreled with him. Then they dug another well. They quarreled over that one also, so he called its name Sitna. And he moved from there and dug another well. They did not quarrel over it, so he called its name Rehoboth, because he said, "For now the Lord has made room for us, and we will be fruitful in the land." The digging of a well was an enterprise of great interest in rural affairs. It conferred a sort of ownership on the digger, and especially in a country where water was precious, this was the case. The well was the scene of young women who would draw water for domestic use, as well as young men and perhaps other young women sometimes, watering their flocks and herds. It was the gathering center of settled life. And so the Philistines became envious, and they were afraid that Isaac would become a settler and acquire rights of property. And so they did what we all would do. They filled his wells in to run him off, to discourage this. Now, there are different ways that we could look at Isaac's behavior regarding his treatment by the Philistines and by Abimelech. He could be seen as a coward. And somebody might think there's a hint of this in verse 24. Verse 23 through 25 is a little short section on its own there. We're told verse 23, he went up from there to Beersheba, and the Lord appeared to him the same night and said, "I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you." Could suggest that obviously he was fearful, but even the courageous experience fear, so you can't make too much out of that. Could be seen as a coward, like I said, or he could be seen as exhibiting a quality that we see demonstrated by David with a little help centuries later, a quality that's encouraged by the Lord. He could be seen as waiting on the Lord, refusing to take matters into his own hands, leaving vengeance for the Lord. You recall in 1 Samuel 25, David and Nabal, and Nabal refuses to give assistance to David and his men, and David's going to take care of this in a manly way, you might say. And on his way there, Abigail meets David and talks to him in a very kind way, very respectful way, and David thanks her for sparing him from taking these matters into his own hands and killing Nabal and others with him, no doubt. And of course, that's somewhat reminiscent of Romans chapter 12, verses 17 through 21, where the Apostle Paul says, "Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord.' Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink. For in doing so, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." It could be that his faith in God's promises that we read about in verses 3 and 4, his faith in these promises kept him from dealing with this in a military way. We just read in verse 16 that apparently he had the ability to deal with the situation. That's the reason why Abimelech asked him to leave that area, because he says, "You are much mightier than we are." Verses 23 through 25 is this instance of him going up to Beersheba and the Lord appearing and saying, "I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for my servant Abraham's sake." And here we see Isaac building an altar and calling on the name of the Lord. In verse 25, he pitched his tent there, and there Isaac's servants dug a well. The last section in this chapter, verses 26 through 33, is an account of Abimelech finally approaching Isaac and wanting to make a covenant with him. We're told in verse 26, Abimelech came to him from Gerar with Ahuzath, one of his friends, and Phicol, the commander of his army. Now, here are two individuals, Phicol and Abimelech, who are mentioned in Abraham's day, some 80 years previous to this, caused some people to scratch their heads and wonder all kinds of things. Are these guys really, really old? Or what is this? And, of course, these could just be titles like Pharaoh and Caesar and many other instances. And that is certainly a possibility. But regardless, they come to him. In verse 27, Isaac, now we see him not being so cowardly, if we were inclined to take that view previously. He says to them, verse 27, "Why have you come to me since you hate me and have sent me away from you?" But they said, "We have certainly seen that the Lord is with you." It's interesting, the word Lord there is Jehovah, which is used numerous times throughout the book of Genesis. But there was an indicator, of course, of that they were concerned about their behavior previous to this. But here clearly he recognizes the God that Isaac serves and worships. "We've certainly seen that the Lord is with you. So we said, let there now be an oath between us, between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you that you will do us no harm, since we have not touched you, since we have done nothing to you but good, and have sent you away in peace. You are now the blessed of the Lord." So he made them a feast, and they ate and drank. They arose early in the morning, swore an oath with one another. Isaac sent them away, and they departed from him in peace. It came to pass the same day, Isaac's servants came and told him about the well which they had dug, said to him, "We have found water." And so he called it Sheba. Therefore, the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. So what do you think of Isaac after this chapter? What conclusions would you draw? Again, there's not a lot of information about him, but in comparison to Abraham, Jacob, and Joseph, it seems safe to say that Isaac was somewhat of a neglected character in terms of the amount of information that's there, in terms of the stories, the information, the accounts that are given to us. He seemed to play a very peripheral role in the Bible narrative. Anybody here ever feel that way? That you just kind of play a peripheral role in life? Don't you think Leah perhaps felt that way? Mistreated, neglected, while she's married to a husband that she knows really wanted to marry her sister. The Lord is blessing her with child after child and refusing to bless her sister, but still, neglect, being mistreated. Joseph's brothers likely felt that way. If you feel that way, does that impact your view of yourself, what you think of yourself, how you value yourself? Does your self-view impact your relationship with God and others? Certainly it does if you let it. There's another situation regarding Isaac that I want to look at for a moment, and that is what I didn't know it was a word till I thought it up. Have you ever done that? You know, maybe I heard it somewhere decades ago. I don't know, but mundanity. It's the noun form of mundane. And it seems that Isaac lived a somewhat mundane life in contrast to the life that the other patriarchs lived. He didn't get to go and get, or he didn't even get to select. I'll get caught up here in a second. He didn't get to select his own wife. According to the biblical record, he did no traveling outside of Canaan. God instructed him, we saw this in verses 2 and 3, do not go down to Egypt, dwell in the land of which I shall tell you, sojourn in this land, presumably in the land of Canaan. That's where we see Isaac. That's the only place that we see Isaac. Contrast that with Abraham, who lived in Ur, a very metropolitan center, traveled some 500 miles northwest to go to Haran, lived there for a period of time, traveled 400 miles south to the land of Canaan, several hundred miles further to go down to the land of Egypt. His passport just had stamps all over it. And Jacob, Joseph, both traveled outside of the land. On a negative note, he didn't even get to meet or have a relationship with his in-laws. On a positive note, he didn't even get to have a relationship with his in-laws. Remember, Jacob got to meet and have a relationship with his in-laws. You have to wonder if he didn't envy his dad. Remember the wedding? Chapter 29, verses 15 through 27. When Jacob travels up north and meets Rachel and kisses her and weeps, and then we're told, verse 15 of Genesis 29, Laban said to Jacob, because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me what your wages should be. Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah. The name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were delicate, but Rachel was beautiful of form and appearance. Now Jacob loved Rachel, and he said, I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. Laban said, It is better that I give her to you than that I should give her to another man. Stay with me. So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed but a few days to him because of the love he had for her. Then Jacob said to Laban, give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go into her. And Laban gathered together all the men of the place and made a feast. It came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to Jacob, and he went into her. Laban gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came to pass in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, what is this you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served you? Why then have you deceived me? And Laban said, it must not be done so in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Fulfill her week. We will give you this one also for the service which you will serve with me still another 7 years. Remember the relationship? Chapter 30, verses 25 through 28. Came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said to Laban, send me away that I may go to my own place and to my country. Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served you, and let me go, for you know my service which I have done for you. Laban said to him, please stay if I have found favor in your eyes, for I have learned by experience that the Lord has blessed me for your sake. Then he said, name your wages, and I will give it. And of course, this is the account of Jacob dealing with the flocks and the herds. We pick up down in verses 42 and 43, when the flocks were feeble, he did not put them in. So the feebler were Laban's, and the stronger Jacob's. Jacob became very powerful, very wealthy as a result of their arrangement. Verse 43, thus the man became, Jacob became exceedingly prosperous, had large flocks, female and male servants, and camels and donkeys. Chapter 31. Jacob heard the words of Laban's son, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what was our father's he has acquired all this wealth. Jacob saw the countenance of Laban, indeed it was not favorable toward him as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your kindred, and I will be with you. So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field to his flock and said to them, I see your father's countenance, that it's not favorable toward me as before, but the God of my father has been with me, and you know that with all my might I have served your father. Your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times, but God did not allow him to hurt me. Down in verses 14 and 15, Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, is there still any portion of inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not considered strangers by him? For he has sold us and has completely consumed our money. And so Jacob does what any good son-in-law would do. He flees. He flees and Laban pursues. Chapter 31, verse 17, Jacob arose and set his sons and wives on camels. He carried away all his livestock, all his possessions, which he had gained, his acquired livestock, which he had gained in Padan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's. Jacob stole away, unknown to Laban the Syrian, and that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. So he fled with all that he had. He arose and crossed the river, headed toward the mountains of Gilead. Laban was told on the third day that Jacob had fled. He took his brethren with him, pursued him for 7 days' journey, overtook him in the mountains of Gilead. But God had come to Laban the Syrian in a dream by night and said to him, be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad. So Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mountains, and Laban with his brethren pitched in the mountains of Gilead. Laban said to Jacob, what have you done that you have stolen away unknown to me and carried away my daughters like captives taken with the sword? How's that in-law thing working for you there, Jacob? Now, I'm not pushing this farther. I'll balance this out in a few minutes, so please don't judge me too harshly yet. We see Jacob's response in chapter 31, verses 36 through 42. Jacob was angry and rebuked Laban, and Jacob had answered and said to Laban, what is my trespass? What is my sin that you have so hotly pursued me? Although you have searched all things, all my things, what part of your household have you found here? Set it before my brethren and your brethren that they may judge between us both. These 20 years I've been with you, your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried their young, and I have not eaten the rams of your flock. That which was torn by beasts I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it. You required it from my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was in the day. The drought consumed me. The frost by night. My sleep departed from my eyes. Thus I've been in your house 20 years. I served you 14 years for your two daughters, 6 years for your flocks. You have changed my wages 10 times. Unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night. Obviously, this is not meant to be some slight to in-laws. It's just to note the obvious that sometimes that which might seem to be a curse can actually turn out to be a blessing. It's sort of like neighbors. Good neighbors can be a great blessing, but it's still acknowledged that even the best of relationships need boundaries. You're familiar with the old saying that good fences make good neighbors. Kind of reminds me of a Grumpy Cat quote. Like a good neighbor, stay over there. Just kidding. Said that it was a late night. It was a late hour of night when the hostess at the reception requested the eminent tenor to sing. He said, It's too late, ma'am. I would disturb your neighbors. And she said, not at all. Besides, last week they poisoned our dog. G.K. Chesterton said, "The Bible tells us to love our neighbors and also to love our enemies, probably because generally they are the same people." Again, that's enough on that. But some might say the same thing about their in-laws. I've had a wonderful relationship with my in-laws, always gotten along with them well, so I'm joking about these comments. It's easy to have a good relationship when you've lived for 30 years between 350 and 1,400 miles away from them. But anyway, it can be easy to get depressed. It can be easy to fall into despair sometimes when things are going bad in your life and you seem to not know where to look, which way to look, which is up. Maybe you feel mistreated, maybe you feel neglected, or because maybe your life seems so mundane in comparison to the life of everybody else around you. Some anonymous rabbi once said, "Despair is a cheap excuse for avoiding one's purpose in life, and a purpose in life is the best way to avoid despair." That which seems to be a curse might actually turn out to be a blessing. We see this with Paul in 2 Corinthians 12, verses 7 through 10. "Lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord three times that it might depart from me. He said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness.' Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong." If we handle our sufferings in the way that the Scriptures instruct us to, the things that we have suffered are the things that create the character that we possess. Someone has said, "Every struggle in life will make you either bitter or better, but you must decide which one." Life will always get the best of us when we focus too much on this life. Paul said in Philippians 4:4-7, a well-known passage, "Rejoice always in the Lord. Again, I will say, rejoice, let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand. Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus." James said in chapter 1, verses 2-4, "Rejoice when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. Let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing." If everything always went the way that we think it should go, every one of us would be miserable, spoiled messes. Without suffering, there would be no growth. Without hunger, there would have been no manna. Without Saul of Tarsus, there would never have been the Apostle Paul. Without the cross, there would never have been a resurrection. Let's stand together and sing the song at this time.